It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, special edition, the Rhetoric Files, rhetoricians interviewing rhetoricians. It's word on word crime, I think, language v. language. So you want to learn some language games, you've come to the right disco. We are here to play those games. I am Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, rhetoric PhD, escape professor, stand-up comedian and comedy writer from over the late night in the crazy world of Hollywood. And I am doing this as a sort of a special series within the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where I bring on some of my favorite rhetorician academics, and we are going to talk rhetoric. So if that's what you're looking for, get ready for some submarining into rhetorical topics. This week, second time I've had him on, Dr. John Llewellyn, professor at Wake Forest University. Southerner, did we established you as a Southerner, right, last time?
As Southern as you can be when you're born in Vermont, yes.
Okay, so Vermont, born free and moved to the South. John does the rhetoric of sports. He's got a big history in politics and general lifery. So welcome, John Llewellyn, once again.
How's it going, John? Thanks, pretty good, man, pretty good.
So you're at the end of the semester. Everybody's educated and just going to come back and thrill you with their acumen here in the final weeks.
That's the plan. That's the plan. We'll see how it shakes out.
I kind of like it that Hannibal Lecter became one of our famous academics, like in the culture. Like who else do we have fictionally that's a, you know, this erudite, thrill me, teach, you know, a teacher?
Well, I don't know where Indiana Jones fits in all of that. Relatively fewer bullwhips in the classroom than you might think if you watch him.
My favorite part about Indiana Jones, he was literally in class one day. How do you get that job?
I've seen something online that says, you know, the real hero of those stories is his TA. Well, he's off in the desert. He's left somebody else to actually, tend right. the flock. And that person, of course, you know, maybe they're deep in the credits someplace, but that's about all the acknowledgement that comes their way.
Oh, that's an academic joke. I'll tell you that. That's perfect. That's exactly right. So we're going to talk today about an academic area that interests you and has interested me in different variations, but it's basically transitions. It's when you are either moved out of one thing into another, or you move from one thing to another, and how do they handle it? And yours, I think your area of interest in this has been with coaches, right? When coaches get moved out. So talk about that a little bit and just orient to this topic for us.
Well, the first thing I'd say is I think sports, because we pay so much attention to it, is an easy and logical place to discuss this. And there's so much of it before us so often. I don't know that it's all that different from other things in life, in fact, but it's more genuinely and sort of automatically interesting to us, and it happens more often and more visibly.
So the media loves to cover it, right? They will tell us every transition.
Oh, and now with the internet, I mean, the teasers and the clickbaity kinds of headlines. And I mean, we're now being invited to worry about what high school sophomores and juniors are possibly imagining as being their schools of choice. And that's, I mean, you know, and somebody's reading it or clicking on it anyhow. So that explains how that happens. But I mean, most of us really don't want to hang our fate on the judgment of a 15-year-old. And yet people seem to be entirely willing to do that.
Well, have you seen, you've seen Hoop Dreams, right? The documentary?
Actually, Peter Gilbert is on our faculty.
Is that right?
The guy who produced that. Lovely human being. I was so pleased to get to meet him. And then over the last, it's probably been 10 years, we've run a doc films program in the university, and he and four or five colleagues are just crushing it. I mean, it's not I mean, they're not effete about it, but it's not Hollywood. It's the power of documentary and social commentary. And he teaches a class for us on creativity, which undergraduates have told me just blew them away. And he's done, I mean, Hoop Dreams is, you know, maybe the most famous thing he's done, but he's done an awful lot of very powerful stuff. So yeah, I know about it. One interesting fact is, and I don't think he advertises it, but, you know, Peter shared some of the proceeds of that with the guys who were the stars, if you will, or who were the, because his logic, I mean, we talked about it just briefly, was, you know, without them, there is no story. This is their story. And, you know, me coming in, carrying a camera and harvesting their life without, and he remains close with at least one of the two guys, maybe both, but I've heard him talk specifically about, you know, going home to Chicago and catching up with this young, well, he'd be a middle-aged man by now, but it certainly wasn't a, you know, let me follow you with a camera for 2 weeks and exploit your life and experience.
Let me take your interesting story. The tradition of not paying documentary versus paying actors, that makes no sense.
Yeah. Let me take your story to my bank.
Where they went all the way back, you know, to those guys in grade school and tracked, you know, all those transition points. And the failure and the success around each one of those, you get this sort of really apex feeling and then this fall from grace, you know, this success arc and then the failure arc that comes around it. And those transitions, those story, you know, that story pyramid that's created right up that apex, you see it with coaches, with politicians, with relationships, with Hollywood celebrities. That is a very strong rhetorical arc right there.
Well, and it's, you know, if rhetoric is how we use language to solve problems or to at least
cause problems.
There's some of that. Navigate them. I mean, look at yesterday's news about Julian Edelman. I mean, this guy who's, you know, who's a saint in New England and this hard scrabble, you know, absolutely reliable receiver. Fails a physical, probably knee shot to heck, I would guess, and he's cut loose. Now he does it graciously, they do it graciously, but the essence of it is, you know, thanks for your life, thanks for your cartilage. Now clean out your locker. And that's after, you know, more than a decade of being, you know, well regarded by his teammates, being a fan hero. You know, being a little guy in a big man's game and all those bases get touched and your rehab doesn't go right. And you're no longer the, at least our doctors are telling us you're no longer the machine that we bought, you know, a while back.
Come on, talk about a bloodless rhetorician. That guy, you know, they'll constantly throw new characters, new heroes up in his storylines, and he doesn't hold on to those people at all. He goes through running backs like nobody I've ever seen.
Well, it's you know, about one wood chipper short of a Coen Brothers movie. I mean, it is. And of course the role of the media and frankly, the role of the fans, with the exception of Brady, and you could even debate that one, they're all interchangeable. You know, we love you big time, long time, except maybe not tomorrow.
Well, in New England, like if we look at these places as little story pockets, you know, the little story factories, they each do their own thing differently. Green Bay, clearly a different type of sports story structure with being community owned and like these long-term, you know, beloved quarterbacks and the characters that carry through over years and years versus a place like New England, which really is, it's almost the denial of story. Like he doesn't want a story structure. He didn't care that Tom Brady was a beloved hero that should have been able to stay in the graces for as long as he wanted. He could care less. He just burned right through it. That's a really different rhetorical approach. I don't guess he sees himself as a rhetorician, but he's in the denial of the story structure of the NFL.
Yeah, well, and it's, as the last 4 years have taught us, if you can get enough people to believe your story, what it's grounded on or not grounded on becomes in some way nearly irrelevant.
Yeah, the story structure itself is going to perseverate, and people want that played out. And I think the Trump phenomenon is a great example of that, right? We see him as a villain. They see him as a anti-villain, you know, an anti-hero. So that he is that sense of, you know, bad boy, rebel, anti-establishment, can't control him. And they read all that, whether it's positive for the country or not.
Well, and you know, you push that a little farther to QAnon, it takes me back to, you know, to a lot of the narrative theory stuff that we studied in graduate school. Is if you want to believe the story bad enough, I mean, what is a con game, but a bad story told well, at least to people who are, you know, who are willing to lean into it. And that can be a business premise, a romantic premise, a policy premise, but that ability to suss out what kind of story this person wants to hear. I mean, they're willing to suspend disbelief. You just have to have the right, preamble to, to dance the dance the way, you know, the way that they imagine it being done. And so, you know, blood drinking pedophiles is an image that some people, I think it's a visceral, no pun intended, thing, in the sense of it feels really good. These people disagree with me on policy, and they come in all kinds of colors, and they love different sorts of people, and that's all very weird. So what's the worst thing I can make them to, you know, to not have to contemplate the possibility that they could be right? and lo and behold, you've got, you know, Planet Pizza or whatever that place is in DC that one of my fellow North Carolinians went up and shot big holes in the belief that, you know, that he was acting to protect the children of the world. It seems wacky, but,
well, this, yeah, but obviously on, people believe story, it. The land of story is nothing but wacky. Like when we start talking about documentaries here, you know, one of the things about documentaries versus full narrative fiction Hollywood, documentaries hold on to a sense of reality and it's supposed to be truth and that kind of stuff. There's a grounding to documentaries, even though, you know, they're storytellers too. But when you start telling stories, throw all the prior stuff about truth and reality and all that out the window. Religion is the greatest example of that. You tell a good story, you know, in a engaging way, you do heroes and villains correctly, which is the QAnon, you know, the blood, the pedophile blood sucking. That's vampires and child molesters crushed into one. What a villain that is.
Yeah. Well,
Dracula never felt up your child, you know.
It's that Kenneth Burke stuff that we studied about. You know, you can't just have mundane evil. You have to have supreme evil. You know, Lex Luthor has to be real Lexi and real Luthery to, you know, to be an adequate, you know, to be a villain worth investing in emotionally.
Yeah. And it's interesting. So if you look at the Democrats as being documentary filmmakers, they love to attach to truth. They don't like to go over into total fiction versus the GOP, which is perfectly fine with fiction. Perfectly fine. Like that whole thing of going down to the border a few weeks ago, the senators, to create, you know, a storyline of a look at these horrible people coming in and they shot it at night on a boat and the, you know, all this stuff. I mean, you're just looking at going, they're doing a fictive storytelling and they're fine with that as a party. I don't think Democrats are more documentary film and these guys are horror film, maybe.
And And once you park the need to have much of a touchstone to reality, then it's all just whatever kind of art you think you're making.
All bets are off, right? Say whatever you want, which is a nice freedom as a rhetorician. Like, you don't have any ethical ties to truth or, you know, all that stuff. It's, and I think the GOP shows that the range of things you can now say and be effective with just incredibly open.
Yeah. So it's, if guilt or shame is supposed to regulate our public performances, then I think the last 4 years disabused us of that notion. I mean, it's almost breathtaking what was said and done, and then followed on the heels of something else that was, you know, by usual standards, bizarre. And at some point you're in psychic overload. I mean, how many times can your mind be blown?
Well, and I explained it today in a tweet joke of a twoke, I don't know, tweak something. I got to come up with a term for that, that they should rebrand as the Dung Beetle Party instead of the Elephant Party, because they literally, rhetorically, they just deal with shit. Like, watching the last couple of weeks, they're still trying to turn Fauci into a villain. Trump was talking about him a few days ago at a fundraiser for the GOP.
Yeah.
And you're like, how could you go after that little elfy guy who's been in public service for that long? And they don't care. They'll turn anybody into a villain because the villain making machine is ready to crank up.
And the, in a perverse kind of way, the lure of villainy. I mean, perfection and uplift is hard work, and but sin is ever beckoning. And
it sure is, John. It sure is.
And that's so, you know, it ain't a hard sell. You just got to relabel it. it seems to me.
Well, pull it back to sports. Like, Belichick or the Patriots PR team did a little bit of this with Brady before they released him, right? They had to villainize him a little bit so that he wouldn't be such a loss, that his arm strength was gone and that he was making bad decisions and they didn't think they could ever win a Super Bowl with him again. They didn't want that 3-4-5 year decline that you had, like, with Joe Montana when he finally had to leave and go to the Chiefs. So yeah, they did. They villainized him within the area of sports.
And like you say, gave themselves a bridge out. Him winning a subsequent Super Bowl somewhere else creates certain narrative constraints on, I mean, but the bottom line is they got him out of town, and his fans and a lot of their fans probably have a kind of a delicious second helping of that, even over against their own intense loyalties. I mean, it'd be interesting to know what, you know, New England fans, I mean, I guess the argument is since our team can't be there, at least our quarterback is there, or somebody.
Yeah, maybe
that
they got a visceral or a secondary victory out of it.
Yeah. And they're not wrong. I mean, they just have to sort of forget the Patriots dirtying him up on the way out, or they either have to forget it or they have to rationalize it in a way that, who knows what they've actually done. But,
well, take this back to one of your worlds that you are incredibly steeped in from sports: Duke versus North Carolina versus North Carolina State. So Duke is the villains, right? I mean, they're villainous. Like, they're easily villainous.
As a graduate of North Carolina, I have no trouble with that premise.
But Duke always has, there's almost always a bad guy on their team.
The Leitner doctrine. Some people. Yeah, you could say that. and of course, those attributions are really needed, especially when they're winning a lot, because you have to dirty them up a little bit to find virtue in third place when, you know, if they're sitting in first.
Well, and you almost look at it like Duke, Duke is the villain in the triad, and then North Carolina, with its whole tradition of Michael Jordans and Dean Smiths and everything, seems like the hero. And then North Carolina State is just neutral. I don't think they have any flavor either way, other than Jimmy V and the, you know, the wonderful kind of hero legacy of that.
Well, and of course, you know, he was in fact a colossal disaster. None of his players graduated. They're getting ready to name a building for him over there, and they forget they fired him not only as head coach but as AD. I was there. I watched. There's something that needs to be said about either the loss of public memory or, I mean, it's the sort of thing that nobody's even said boo. I mean, you don't remember any of that stuff. You don't read the
story. That story tsunami that came in, you know, with the cancer and never ever give up, and the replay of that imagery of the last second victory against the Giant. You know, there's nothing that can compete with that rhetorically. None of your reality or truth. Get that out of here.
Well, the other thing that I think may have helped a bit was his brother working at ESPN. Which in a way, I mean, the elements you point to are the stronger piece, I would say, but it was also, it seemed to me at least, like kind of an in-house project at ESPN, that this is in a indirect way burnishing our brand because of these various kinds of connections. And so, you know, if you look at the harm done at Iona and Jeff Ruland, there's a lot more people scattered by the wayside. Chris Washburn, you may or may not remember him, but
I do. I remember all these guys. Yeah,
Valvano sent him a letter every year. I'm sorry, every year, every day, from the time he was in the eighth grade. He got a letter from the NC State coach every day they delivered mail until he signed with NC State. He's now a guest of the state of North Carolina in prison because that's all of the fawning that came with his incredible athletic talent. Basically, you know, was exactly the opposite of what the development of his character, you know, called for. And so he's had a couple stints in prison. And, you know, he's probably spent three times as much in prison as he did in the NBA. And he should have been, he should have had a 12-year career in the NBA, given his skills. But,
well, and you see this, I'm amazed, like Bill Self got a lifetime contract with Kansas recently. And like, I get it. The guy wins and he can clearly recruit. Something's going on there. But wasn't that guy just under semi-indictment for paying Nike or Adidas for players? Didn't that just happen?
Well, I would assume that there's some kind of a shroud or fog or something like that, because of course that's what led to Sean Miller's departure at Arizona. And you know, when the FBI has you on tape, that's not a good place to start.
Right. I thought the Self was the same thing. I thought he was recorded.
I honestly don't recall that. My own instinct about it would be, given his scale, if that were true, he would be a bigger story if it had happened that way.
We'll have to look it up. I remember going, oh yeah, that guy always seems a little slippery to me. But so this idea, this villainy, right? Like, so we're still walking on both sides of the bridge of true villains. Like you're talking about the truth of Valvano versus these high profile story villains and heroes. And to me, rhetorically, it's so dominant right now, this idea of if you create the story correctly and you just keep hitting the gong over and over and over, your documentariness and your real lifeness doesn't really have a chance against it. And that is the story of Trump. Trump just hit the gong again and again and again and again. No matter what the actual information was.
Well, and to follow that idea, you could argue that, you know, that Biden's attempting to make more of a documentary, or more nearly a documentary, about actual people in real life and tangible qualitative problem solving, as opposed to festivals of symbolism and insult and, you know, the other sort of symbolic actions that were, I mean, much of the Trump administration was symbolic.
Just and, symbolic, and yet, right? It was just tell the story.
Yeah.
At least Biden does have some policy and some action underneath this stuff, but he's telling the story of a Camelot story, a hero story. He's just trying to put America in as the hero instead of himself, but he's right there next to it, you know?
Yeah. And that could work. I mean, if you look back in history, Frances Perkins did a lot of stuff that FDR got credit for. He was the president, but she was the brains of a lot of really important social policy. And it's that old axiom, you know, you can get a lot done if you don't care who gets the credit. And maybe, I mean, if you look at the cabinet secretaries and other folks that Biden's put in place, you know, maybe we'll have a revisitation of that. I mean, maybe Buttigieg is going to be, you know, he's going to make a case for being president in 16 years based upon how, you know, what he accomplishes in transportation and how effective he helps, you know, the Biden administration be.
He's been a fascinating character. I'd love to hear your read on him. I mean, coming from, I watched him at the very emergence when he emerged as mayor, you know, that was his character, mayor,
right,
you know, in Indiana. And then his first emergence was sort of as an intellectual character, that he spoke 8 languages and yada, yada. They went away from that pretty quickly. And then he has the touchstones of military service. He's done government service. He's married and he's gay. And he's educated. So he's got these touchstones for his story. I'm just curious as to how that's going to well up. Like, do you think he's got to go get bona fides for pragmatic, wonky kind of actual government work? Like, what is his pathway to presidency when you look at it, building himself as a, is it a millennial hero? What is it?
Well, I mean, it is, as you say, I think the, you know, it's a long way from being a mayor to being, you know, to running, you know, something massively larger. Because in theory, you know, a mayor can get his or her hands on pretty much everything under, you know, under their control. Where he is now, he's actually going to have to accomplish things through other people, seems to me. And that's, you know, not only that you have policy, but that you can make policy happen, that you can convert it into grounded stuff. I mean, I think part of what he's done so far is build a record, and I think it seems legitimately so. If you're going to dislike him, you're going to have to dislike him because he's gay. You know, you can't gripe about public service.
Or educated, you can't, you know, or liberal.
Or smarty pants. But all of the, I mean, if you took the gay dimension out of the equation, what would you criticize about his pathway to public prominence? What is he, you know, maybe he wasn't as great a mayor as all that. Okay, well, what, you know, what would be the shortcomings? And so in some ways, I mean, there's some normalizing going on, even though there's a slice of the population that will never, or that it seems to me at least will be very late to the party about normalizing. But by the time that happens, it may not matter. I mean, if, you know, if 80, 85% of the population is, you know, everybody knows they're here, get over it, then that 15% isn't going to be able to coalesce around anything that matters. I think
it'd be interesting, like if you and I were his rhetorician advisors, you know, I guess they call them something different in political world, but essentially it's telling him how to build his rhetoric, like what he's doing now about getting some bona fides, some actual evidence of effectiveness, you know, mm-hmm. and governance is part of it. Although Trump never needed that, though, I guess he tried to, you know, grab it from his mythical success in business. So like his touch points that he needs to be a hero, and then his touch points that he needs to avoid villainy are sort of in place. And I think like with him, what's probably going to happen for villainy is they'll just associate him with villains. Like it doesn't seem a lot that there's a lot that would stick to him as a villain, as a human being. He touches a lot of good American, you know, hero points.
Right.
But like they did to John Kerry, who I knew was going to lose the presidential election when he accepted the nomination by saying, you know, Lieutenant or Corporal, whatever it was, Kerry reporting for duty. I'm mm-hmm. like, did you just harken back to Vietnam? They're going to kill you on Vietnam. And they did, you know, because yeah. they just associated him with an evil war and, you know, all the kind of, you know, slander they did with him. So I assume that's what they'll do to Buttigieg in some ways. They'll try to find associations that he has that they can slander.
Yeah, he's not really what he says he is, or we can tell you a more, I mean, it's really, same thing's true with Kerry, whether we'll be any smarter if there's a swift voting of Buttigieg. I mean, will we, you know, does the first one work because of novelty? Or do they all work because we really like to see the mighty brought low, especially in a such a derogatory, demeaning way? Because it isn't just an untruth; it's a perversity of an untruth. I mean, you did.
Yeah. Well, it's again that story heightening of the yeah. villainy, and again, it has nothing to do with reality or whatever. Can we make this stick? And I think the murkiness and the ugliness of Vietnam. That's why I said he's in trouble, because he just associated himself with a very unpopular war on all sides. There was nobody walked out of there with honor or good feeling. Why would you do that? You want to leave that behind. And at least with Buttigieg's military service, it doesn't have that kind of, you know, horrible complication yet in the military images of it, at least.
I think you're right. But you know, there's another incarnation of the swift boat people out there somewhere trying to figure out a social media whispering campaign, you know, child molester, who knows? I mean, there's the one thing you can know is there will be no bottom, you know, there will be no,
Well, that was one of Biden's super advantages, don't you think? He'd been in public eye for 40 years, so he had been completely vetted. They tried to get him with senility and then associating him with a deviant son, but he just kind of shrugged those off and kept going.
Well, and the alleged plagiarism with the speech from back in the day. You know, as I understand it, he had rolled pretty well with that. And it was, on second view, it was mostly a misunderstanding. But on first view, it was handled in such a way that it was able to, you know, to knock him off balance. And that was, yeah, and that was really yeah, kind of was, the point. Yeah.
The Anita Hill and then the busing and the gun, you know, gun legislation, all sorts of stuff like that. But they're little dings, really, you know. And I think maybe that's what it's going to. The politicians are so old now because they've got to survive so much attack.
Yeah. If you were going to blow yourself up, you probably would have by now. I mean, if you had either actually done something problematic enough, or if you were thin skinned enough, one way or the other, some bullet would have gotten through by now. And the fact that it hasn't is, I mean, that may be good luck. That may be good armoring. That may be everything's been tried, and so there's not really a novelty, you know, everything is old news, which you know, which probably helps. You know, it's an ask and answered kind right. of a thing that they do in law. You know, we've seen that, we've been there, we know what that's about.
Yeah, it's not fresh meat. So
you got to have another angle.
Take a look at that from the Hillary Clinton perspective. The fact that she had been attacked for so long, there was so much hints of villainy and, you know, the original conspiracy theories of Whitewater, and I saw murder conspiracy theories when I was in North Carolina. One of the secretaries who was half nuts on the conspiracy side put flyers in all the professors' mailboxes about all the people that the Clintons had killed. And she got, you know, sucked over into her husband's wake, his villainous wake, with, you know, some of that kind of stuff. But how would you work with her? Like, did she have enough hero? To me, she had so much villainy, even if it was false villainy. I don't know what the heroism was, other than the fact that she would not go away. She was so tenacious. She was a successful female. She was smart. You know, she was a survivor.
Those are all, of course, offenses in, you know, in some rule books. Because I mean, my brother-in-law was in her law firm, and I know people who've known her for, you know, 50 years. She's the smarter of the two. I don't think there's much argument about that. And she came to Arkansas, you know, as a hippie girl from New England and by way of the Midwest, and started working, you know, to help with kids and their legal rights and how the state dealt with them and all that from the beginning. And I think there's some people who never forgave that. I mean, the very idea that you would use law and policy in this way when we have in place the actual system that we want, even though it's extra legal and in some cases not legal at all. And you know, how dare you try to impose regular order on our ways. But she's a very capable person. But I think that's part of why they went after her is, I mean, they went after her in Arkansas, and they went after her, you know, in 92 and beyond. Because there's somebody over on the other side of the street who's sitting there saying, and I know this because of people I know who've known Bill Clinton for a long time, you know, where's the talent pool? Where are the 30 to 40 year old talented Democrats? How do we kneecap them? You know, there's one way you win the race is, you know, by the time somebody's 45 or 50, you make sure they don't show up the starting line.
Right.
And that's a form of the long game of you know, it's like giving your opponent arthritis 20 years before you expect to have to meet them, or building up that. I mean, it's a, you know, I win when you lose model, and let me, you know, I'm going to put acid rain on you for 20 years. And then I'm going to complain that you've got scars.
Yeah. She is one of the most slandered people in history, without a doubt.
And I think the ultimate sin is being, well, I mean, look at corporate boards, look at the professoriate. I mean, there, you know, our incoming president of Wake Forest is a woman. That's news, but the year is 2021. So, you know, it's this is not 1990. So, But still, that, you know, it's possible to give offense by simply being alive and by claiming your oxygen.
Right. And all that, you know, the sort of sad villainy of coming into the South, not being from the South. You know, Clinton, Bill was from the South, so he was authentic. She yeah. was an East Coast intellectual. Just amazing, these games of villain and hero, and how they do transcend across so many settings, whether it is sports or politics. I've worked a lot in business in the last 5 to 8 years, and trying to get people to understand these big story structures play out into your marketing for your company and your people. And if you don't understand them, then you are, first of all, you're incredibly susceptible to attack.
Right.
And your entire business can crumble. Look at Jared from Subway.
Right.
How do you go from this innocuous, you know, semi-hero for that many years? Somebody lost weight and could basically be a nerd who was successful in public, just off a cliff. The amount of money that cost that company, you can't even
calculate it. Well, I tell my students, and that's why there's Ronald McDonald, because he has no private life. He's a costume that's kept in a closet and that a hired actor is put in every so often. And there are rules about, where and when he shows up and how he disappears and all the rest of that. And as weird and artificial as that is, you don't get a Jared out of it. That's a fascinating, when you bet on a horse, and the horse blows up in the backstretch, one stop at an airport and having a phone scanned for some particular reason of, kiddie porn. I mean, whatever it might be, we carry around with us evidence of our crimes, if there are any, in all sorts of easily detectable forms. And Jared is a perfect, in one of the classes I teach, we talk about, about the ways corporations, what are the benefits of spokespeople and what are the downsides? And that's as good an example as there can be of what in the world could possibly go wrong. Well, try this on. How do you like it now?
I describe it sometimes as this flippable coin, right? A villain hero. Like, it's sitting right there. Like, you are both. Everyone is both. So if people over here, if like you're a super progressive, innovative, educated, nice person, for the Democrats and for liberal people, that's a hero. For non-education people, traditionalists and things like that, that's a villain. So you hold these on both sides of that coin at all times. It's just where's it going to flip? Who's going to be able to flip it?
And that's why we have Fox News. Yeah, I can't think of another reason right off, but a place to liberate those narratives, to elevate, to repeat, to entrench in a world filled with goodness, we may not need, but we're about to get an infusion of snark. We're going to get some Tucker, or we're going to get some Hannity, and all of the smug. What's interesting, I mean, there are many things interesting about watching them, but one thing is just pay attention to the adjectives. Doesn't matter what the nouns are. By the time you've got the adjectives, you've got the story. And especially when they're strung together, I find it remarkable, because you don't have to know much of anything. You're going to know, you may not know the words, but you're going to know the music by the time, the first two sentences are out of either of those guys' mouths.
Well, even before that, I'm always fascinated by the portrayal of emotionality, especially Tucker. He looks, he portrays maybe three emotions of, he's constantly aghast, he's disgusted, and it's on his face all the time. Like, he just can't believe, like, how could you, and it's this constant portrayal of those agitated emotions that I think people are absorbing when they watch Fox and when they listen to right-wing media. It's that absorption of the emotion that I see, and that triggering, that constant triggering of the emotional part of your brain that's worried and anxious and hateful and all that. So it's orchestra of emotions, and they only play one side of the orchestra.
Yeah. Well, and you throw in Limbaugh, and you throw in InfoWars guy, and you've got this perennially outraged, pissed off, can you even believe it, abomination around the next corner.
It's a dark orchestra of dark emotions, and they play it.
But there's something, I mean, if you look at some of what you see with the people who, you know, who invaded the Capitol on the 6th, if you listen to their talk, I mean, there's this, it reminds me a little bit of Ghostbusters with that river of evil that was under the city. I mean, there's this acidic bile that is, you know, that is very literally and figuratively distasteful, but there's something, I mean, it's a cheap thrill. You know, it's not the joy of watching a child be born or of raising up a young person or of helping somebody in a classroom. It is everything sucks and everything sucks terribly, but you and I are smart and we know it. And let's all circle around the campfire and denounce it. Now, it's that old thing about, you know, any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a craftsperson to build one. Well, we got a lot of jackass barn kicking, seems to me, going on. That is the reason why it's its own reward. You know, accomplishment is difficult, but bitching is easy. It's one of the things you learn in graduate school, among other places. And it just seems to me that there's that whole subgenre of our public discourse that is always, I mean, it looks like a low, but it's actually a high. You know, if you watch InfoWars and that just that crescendo of denunciation, and I mean, life may be terrible and there's all these issues, but by God, this guy knows it and he's clear about it. And if I'm clear with him, then at least I've got that I can hang on to. And that kind of, you know, it's like a bodily political allergic reaction to any form of humanity or any set of values that, you know, that isn't on the approved list.
I'm curious, when you think about this, like, what is the catharsis for having gone to a dark symphony and absorbed all this emotionality? Like, the catharsis for, typically, I guess, in story structure is you run into obstacles and villainy and you're hoping for the good people to win. And the catharsis is when they do. But what happens when it's this constant darkness? I guess they can put up any hero that they want or anybody that seems heroic at the end. But what is the catharsis when you have anxiety and hate and anger and neurosis all the time, when you're constantly outraged?
Well, if you look at QAnon, I mean, you know, the families that are broken up, all the challenges has come from that. I mean, it's a little bit like that study when prophecies fail. You know, if it doesn't turn out the right way, some people bail on the movement and other people double down. And I think the harder you grip. And I think that's the payoff, is that you are, you know, the world is black and terrible, but you are one of the chosen, you know, you are Illuminati, you are illuminated, and you know what's true, and everybody else are the sheeple and, you know, all the rest of that stuff. So the superiority, you know, I mean, you're still driving a 12-year-old truck and, you know, you got a mortgage the size of a mountain, but you know, and others don't, and you can get, you know, you can get all the booster shots you want from, you know, between Fox and InfoWars and you know, whoever's going to try to pick up the Limbaugh mantle, of just, you know, having it confirmed and reconfirmed that it may be weird, but you're seeing it right. whatever satisfaction. I mean, that's a kind of a limited satisfaction, but.
And I think they do. They end up in this state of perpetual uncatharticized emotion. There never really is catharsis for it. It just recycles itself over and over again. And I've seen a lot of people spiral deeper and deeper down to where you get to the level of a QAnon and you can now accept, you know, blood, you know, sucking pedophiles, because you never get to escape that feeling, the darkness of that. Where I think on the right, on the left, they're always looking for catharsis. And I think people got it with Biden, right? They're still trying to get more and more of it. Every time a positive thing comes out that, you know, like when everybody spontaneously danced in the street because he won, there was a sense of catharsis. The good people got to release, to escape Mordor, escape the darkness. And, but the dark people still are there. Like they haven't escaped anything.
And imagine where we would be if Georgia hadn't gone the way it did. I mean, if Trump weren't the colossal horse's patoot that he proved himself to be. I mean, really politically unastute in, you know, in biblical proportions. Imagine if McConnell had the Senate right now, where would this country be and where would the national psyche be?
So what do we do? So we've got this sense. So I see this a lot with, again, the left and liberals, that they find catharsis all the time. I think like yoga is catharsis. Like people do like, oh, my life, but I got to go do yoga. And then they'll get a temporary sense of catharsis from it. They find these temporary catharsis. But the people that are still in the dark, kept in that dark sense of non-cathartic emotion, they're still voting. They're still out there. They're still unhappy. What do we do? What kind of catharsis can we offer them? Because they don't want to go to yoga. We got to offer them something to get them out of, you can't just criticize them and fear them. And that's part of my thing with the Rhetoric Warriors Project is I want to give you some tools for going into that darkness and bringing them out. You know, what do you offer them when you've listened to the right-wing orchestra for this long?
Well, you know, in some ways that's part of what's, I mean, you could see that as the way that that the Biden appeals for bipartisanship are. I mean, it's there's a certain slice of it that's genuine, and there's another slice of it that's, to me at least, says I'm giving you one more chance.
Sure.
You know, the before door's I still cracked. Before I lower like the hammer. Yeah. Right. But that, it seems to me that, I mean, this is, I look at this as Eros and Thanatos, you know, it's love and death. And one side, I mean, you know, you pursue one and you know for damn sure you're going to get the other. But
is that it? Do they need a good war, like a good satisfying war?
Well, but look at what we've done in relation to the pandemic. If Pearl Harbor happened tomorrow, how many people would say, that ain't my problem. I mean, if you think isolationism just stops at the water's edge, I mean, we got people who are, you know, who are invited to put a piece of cloth over their face to help improve public health and are prepared to die on that hill, but they won't be dying on a Pacific island.
I feel like, again, in some ways, we're asking these people that still feel saturated with darkness to do one more small thing, and they just reject it. So if we were to say, look, there's a Hitler and we all have to pull together, it feels like, I think you're right with this love and death. Like these are death-oriented people. They're not experiencing love. They're not experiencing happiness and elation and euphoria. They are still holding on to this darkness and they're caught in there. And I'm not sure we're approaching it right as rhetoricians. We're not offering them ways out. We're not offering them catharsis and pathways out of that.
No, that is the $64,000 question. I mean, because if the motto of one perspective is bleep your feelings, then how do you help that side, or what message would cause that side to examine its own feelings and to find some other reason to be alive and some other reason to get up in the morning and to have a positive relationship with neighbors and to be if they choose, members of a faith community. I mean, what's when you've been motivated? I mean, it's kind of like, well, I don't, I mean, this is my analogy, it may not be true, but you know, how do you get a heroin addict out of, I mean, from what I understand, heroin's a lot of fun. It has some byproducts that are not so good for your life, but the high itself is quite a high. Well, how do you come back from that, even though that high is so destructive of your long-term interests?
Well, I think of it sometimes like my father was a contrarian, cranky old guy, you know, like to say
hard
no.
To imagine, but okay, yeah.
Love to say no. Love to not offer endorsements and credibility to others. So found fault with things. And I see a lot of people as they get crankier, they get, you know, when they're sick or they're caught, you know, in this sort of negative emotion, negative space, they can't get success, they're under stress, they can't get happy relationships. And so I know some of the strategies that I used with my dad to try to lift him out of that emotionality, because he was caught in an orb of this emotion. And in some ways it was just perseverating. It was just an habituation. Yeah. He didn't know how to get out of it. And yeah. So like I would do things like meta with him. Like I would do a little meta, get him try to get to an abstract level of like, you know, how often are you happy every day? Like how much happiness is there in your everyday life? And, you know, at first he'd be like, I don't care about being happy. But you let him get through that little storm and then get him to actually introspect a little bit just on that, not about what's right in the world or whether people are lying to you, but how much happiness are you experiencing? And I find that really useful when I talk to people from the right that I'm trying to convert. It's just to get them to take some stock of their own happiness. And is there enough of it? Because it's unpleasant being upset and outraged and hateful and all those things. They're not pleasant to be in that state. So I find that's a little bit of an inroad, that if you can get people to think, okay, well, what would make me happier then? You know, is it Donald Trump being president? Is it a bigger wall at the southern border? Is that going to make you happy?
Those are very good questions. I mean, I think that, you know, everybody's entitled, and you would wish it for everybody, but how, when the spiral has, you know, has corkscrewed into the ground, as some of these seem to have, I mean, the old joke goes, what is it that the Proud Boys are proud about? You know, I mean, what's, and is there, you know, might there be something more transcendent about which to be proud, or something that one could do that would create a genuine feeling of efficacy, satisfaction, you know, I've earned my oxygen today, whatever, you know, whatever would represent that positive, you know, that positive outcome. I think that's a very, I mean, I don't feel like I have much of an answer at the moment, but I think that's a very good question, because, well, I mean, it isn't enough simply to say we're stuck with these folks, because they're stuck with us too. So, I mean, if that's fairness, then we have
fairness. We're wonderful, John.
Yeah. Well, we're cuddly and charming. What's the problem? But I think it would be, I mean, what is a good life that doesn't involve the denial of a good life to others? Because part of the problem, I think, has been that the reward structure that's been created, at least over the last 4 years, has been, you'll be happier if all of these people are, you know, dispossessed, harmed, whatever it happens to be. About your happiness on its own?
It's that idea of, they don't even say happy. They just say you need to remove these things because they are causing unhappiness. But to me, like lighting a beacon on the hill of, hey, what makes you happy? So if you're a racist, for example, we all know racists. We know they still exist in the world. You and I lived in very racist, you know, cultures. at different times in our life that have evolved towards certain things and away from certain things. What, instead of indicting racists and making sort of easy kind of villains out of them, which is, you know, done constantly, what about the question is if you talk to somebody who has racist ideas, what does it make, does that make you happy? Like, do you, believing these things, like, does it enliven your life? Like I used to say, when people move out to Los Angeles, it's really difficult being a racist in Los Angeles because you'd be exhausted.
Yeah.
And you can't even tell what nationality people are. And there's so much mixed nationality and so much sort of polyglot and interesting, you know, cultures intertwining with each other that you end up celebrating it. Because there's really no other option how to exist there and hold on to negativity, because that's all you'd ever feel. Mm-hmm. So even just approaching things through an emotional rhetoric, I think is a really useful way to opening up options for people that are caught in this of like, I don't care about what you believe or who you hate or anything else. Let's talk about making you happy. So, are you happy, John?
Well,
that's my point. John, are you happy?
we're not going to get anywhere without that. I think that's, I mean, simply, you know, who are wearing the white hat and the black hat. I mean, that's, you know, that's always going to be perceptual, but, you know, happiness isn't even, I mean, it can be the reduction of worry. I mean, I think more of a safety net is probably, I mean, more as if we had much of one. But I've spent some time in New Zealand and some other places where, you know, you don't have as many Jeff Bezoses, but you have sort of a social floor that people rarely fall below. And that is more than just literal leveling. I mean, there's a kind of a potential mateship that comes with that is, that certainly is not abroad in the land that we're currently navigating.
Yeah, we burn other firewood in our camps. Like I think we do forget things. Like, that's one of the things I've always liked about you, John. You have a sense of joviality to you. I think you enjoy life. I think you know how to pursue enjoyment and happiness. Your kids are happy people. You know, I've always admired that about you, that you've got that feeling and that you pursue it well. So,
yeah, I've got some very interesting friends.
That helps, right? Maybe that's the right just needs more friends. Maybe everybody befriend a person on the right. Go to go to Rhetoric Warriors and take the course on converting one conservative. That's my social program right now. Just pick one, befriend a conservative, and just be nice to them. Watch them slowly come around.
We could do a whole lot worse.
For sure. Well, John, it's been super fun, man. I knew it would be again.
Same.
I appreciate
here.
It.
My pleasure.
You make sure those students leave highly educated.
We're working on it.
Put more good people out in the world, and we'll keep doing our thing. I appreciate everybody. It's John Llewellyn, Wake Forest University. I don't know. You don't really sell anything, but
not hardly.
Root for UNC. That'll help
them
out.
That's okay. And Wake.
All right, man. I will talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.